Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Business Brew. I am your host, Bill Brewster. This episode features Darren Fisk. Darren is the CEO and founder of Forum Investment Group. Forum does everything real estate related. They do credit, they do equity. And this conversation happens to be mostly focused on multifamily. I hope you enjoy it. I enjoyed it. It's an asset class I have an interest in, so there's going to be more and more of these, but this is a good perspective on the private side of the business. Additional disclosure, this material is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as and may not be relied on or in any manner as legal, tax, or investment advice, a recommendation, or as an offer to sell, a solicitation of an offer to purchase, or a recommendation of any interest in any fund or security offered by Forum Capital Advisors, LLC, or its affiliates. Private market investments are complex, speculative investment vehicles not suitable for all investors. An investment in a private market investment entails a high degree of risk, and no assurance can be given that any private market investment objectives will be achieved or that investors will receive a return of their capital. The information contained herein is subject to change without prior notice and is also incomplete. The industry information and its importance is an opinion only and should not be relied upon as the only important information available. Information contained herein has been obtained from sources believed to be reliable but not guaranteed, and Forum assumes no liability for the information provided. Past performance is not a guarantee nor a reliable indicator of future results. As always, nothing in the show is financial advice. Please consult an investment advisor before making investment decisions. Everything in the show is for entertainment purposes and educational purposes, and do your own due diligence. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thrilled to be joined by Darren Fisk today. Darren, how are you?
Doing great. Might be a little bit too early to tell, but off to a good start.
It's like 8 and you get up at what, like 4:30? So you've had a full day.
Yeah. I know. It's almost time for me to go to bed.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting schedule. That'd be nice if you could only be up 4 hours a day, although you'd miss a lot, I guess. Anyway, it's neither here nor there. Darren, you want to tell people about yourself and what you do?
Sure. Just a little background. Our company here, Forum, we're actually the only multifamily group in the U.S. that has three different strategies all under one roof. When I say that, we do debt, we do credit, and in three different fund vehicles, and then we have ground-up development as well. So a lot of folks are investment managers, and they allocate. We actually manufacture our own stuff, meaning we develop our own assets. About 75-80% of the loans that we make are direct to our borrowers. So been a unique journey over the last, I would say, 23 years, of which I started off in the real estate finance business and saw an opportunity in the GFC in 2008 to start developing and buying multifamily. And so fast forward today, we roughly have, as I mentioned, three different strategies.
I mean, obviously you were lending, but what specifically were you doing pre-GFC?
I knew I wanted to get into real estate. My mom and dad were school teachers and a principal. And so we had about 13 units in the Bay Area, Northern California. And I always loved real estate, but I was our framer and our drywaller and electrician and doing all these things. And right after college, I got a little tryout with the Atlanta Falcons. I said, well, what am I going to do? I want to get into, you know, real estate. And I was tiling bathrooms at 10 o'clock at night and talking to some friends. I realized if I good financially how things went together, I could go buy things, I could hire a development person, I could hire property managers. And so a company that was called Johnson Capital. We had 17 offices. Myself and a partner ran the office here in Denver and all of our loan servicing. So we represented Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, HUD, and a bunch of different life insurance companies. And so I just had this, you know, I don't know, it was like a pull towards multifamily. And I don't know if it was because I grew up in a small town and small community, but really took to multifamily. So there were a bunch of REITs here in Denver, Aimco, the former Archstone, UDR, and then one commercial group called Black Creek. And really was just focused on the multifamily side, from large REITs to the mom and pops. And the lending business got me into buying with one of my old partners in 2003. And then when the GFC hit, like I mentioned, we started our development company. We bought about 9,000 units from 2009 to 2012. The lending business is really what gave me the start to building Forum.
It's a nice time to buy.
Wish it was back. Wish we had more money and more opportunity. There was plenty of opportunity. I had real, real young kids at the time, and I was gone on the road, flying around everywhere. HUD at the time had this 221D4 program where they provide non-recourse construction loans, and they were foreclosing, like a lot of lenders were, on their multifamily assets. So we were flying around the U.S. looking at these different properties that HUD had in these big pools. The problem was we didn't have the money. And so a lot of these larger groups, real estate groups that were out there, were buying these pools, and then we'd buy directly from them, you know, 30, 45 days after they closed, and we'd go syndicate, you know, kind of from a thesis. We'd pass around an offering memorandum, and a bunch of folks that I met in 03 at the gym, the first deal we ever bought, we raised $3.3 million for a 252-unit apartment building in Albuquerque. And it was folks like that that I would call on each and every time. And one of the things, the ironic things about that first deal, we still own it today. We've refinanced our money out three times since 2003, so 21 years ago. We bought that property, and about a year later, we refinanced it and got 100% of our money back. And I thought, wow, what a racket this is.
Yeah, is that good? That seems good.
And it seems pretty good to me, especially when you don't pay tax on that refinance at the time that you do it. So I think people think that real estate is a, you know, get rich thing, but I think with cap rates declining and interest rates coming down, it seemed that way. And now we're back to more of the norm, where it takes time to create value in real estate. And we did that, and we're patient. And really, you know, Bill, one of the things that I learned early on, and it was actually a saying that my father-in-law said to me, said, Darren, if there's one thing I teach you in life, remember this. And I thought, oh God, don't touch your daughter, or what, you know, what's it going to be? He said, cash is king, but cash flow is queen. If you wake up next to the queen the rest of your life, you're going to be a happy man. I thought about that forever. And so I think so many times people think about having cash. In my mind, the secret to life was having cash flow, where when you wake up in the morning, you have a check coming, and you're not waiting till you retire to cash in your IRA or your 401k. And so the basis of Forum in the early years, we were just cash flow, cash flow, cash flow. If we couldn't get 1% a month, be nice, you know, on an amortizing basis, we wouldn't do it. And as you know, interest rates started going down, cap rates went down, and it's probably 5 years ago, it was 7% a year, maybe, interest only. And so the market's definitely changed over the years, and I think, as we'll probably talk about, we've changed with it.
I mean, obviously, cap rates have changed. I mean, how competitive was the market, let's say, from like 2015 to 2020? I mean, you're talking about buying things in the global financial crisis. I mentioned it on the pod before, but I was listening to Steve Schwarzman talk at some lunch. It was just a lunch that UBS had. And he talked about buying real estate at like 6x cash flow, basically. And, you know, he's talking about if you can do that and you lever it, like, you're always going to make money. And I was thinking to myself, okay, well, that's like a very nice story, but where the heck am I going to find that now? And I'm just kind of curious to hear you talk a little bit about what it was like getting deals in the financial crisis versus, you know, sort of like when things normalized leading up to whatever 2020 and 2021 was, and where you see us now, and how over time you've sort of shifted where you're playing? I think that should be a question that'll take about an hour to answer.
Yeah. Wow. Well, you know, when the GFC hit and I was a lender, two of my clients were partnered on a prospective development in Boulder, Colorado, and I had arranged a HUD 221-D4 loan for them. Well, one of them got in trouble, and the other one said, "Hey, Darren, I can't move forward without Jim." And I said, well, to Lou, was the other partner, I said, "Lou, if you get this property entitled in Boulder, I'll get it built." He said, "What do you know about building?" So I said, "Well, my father's a retail developer and I can find a development partner, what have you." So it's 2009. We own, you know, 4.5 acres in the 29th Street Mall in Boulder, and nothing over 50 units had been built in 25 years.
Oh, wow.
And not only were there no land comps, but there were also no rent comps to support it. So we actually had to go out of state to get comps. But I knew one thing, that real estate in Boulder was like a piece of gold if you could get it entitled. So we had a non-recourse loan with HUD. All I knew is I couldn't afford not to get that commission for the loan. So if I couldn't get the commission, I might as well, you know, build this as well to keep
throw the going. Hail Mary. Why not?
Right. And look, it's easy to look back on life and tell a story. But back then I was like, I just couldn't believe I had the opportunity to do it, that I actually could get this site. So we ended up building it. It turned out great. We ended up buying the property next door. We built Google's campus up there in Boulder as well. But going back to multifamily, I was the only one in Colorado in 2009 developing. So I got a call from another gentleman here in Denver. We then had another two projects, 300 and 362 units going by 2010. All while my day job of real estate finance, I'm now a real estate developer at night, found a wealthy partner here in Denver. So we had almost 1,000 units under construction by 2010.
Wow.
While we're also trying to buy things. And you asked the question, you know, how it was like, for me, it was like Fred Flintstone in Rock Vegas. It was like bet, right? Like there was just like deal. And as fast as we could fly around the U.S. to buy these HUD loans, you know, to get these developments going. And if I hit the pause button, Bill, and I looked, I wish I could write a book like The Lessons Learned or What Not to Do. Not what to do, but what not to do. I learned through the GFC in 08 that my friends that were single family home builders went bankrupt. They were out of business. And I realized something, just kind of connecting the dots, that if you're a one-trick pony and the market shuts off and you could fast forward today, real estate development's really tough today. If you're just a developer, you're either laying everybody off or you're going to, I don't know what you're doing. And if you're just an acquirer of real estate and like in multifamily right now, you're probably not doing much either. And so looking back, I said, okay, well, I want to be able to invest throughout a real estate cycle, not to a cycle. We today have debt, we have credit, and we have our equity products. And if we didn't have our debt products today, I don't know what I'd be doing. We haven't bought anything in 4 years. Hmm. We had 8 developments planned for 2023 and they didn't pencil. We didn't start one of them. We have one development we're working on right now in San Diego that actually pencils well just because of the land basis. So going back to 08 again, what did we learn? We were buying as fast as we could. If we, you know, you're buying stuff at such a low basis, you know, $40,000 a door. And we were in Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, Alabama, all these secondary and tertiary markets. Fast forward today, we sold out of a lot of those markets during COVID because, again, there was another demographic shift. People that were in New York or that lived in Montgomery, Alabama were like, hey, I'm going to go try Denver out. And then their parents are saying, hey, Johnny, when are you coming back to, you know, Montgomery? And Johnny says, never. I'm never, like, I found Denver. This place is great. Or I found, you know, Austin, Texas. And so also understanding these demographic shifts and where they're going has helped our awareness of where we want to position our portfolio moving forward. So we were buying a lot. You ask about 2015. It's really about the time we started slowing down on the acquisition side. We really started focusing more on the development side. We never did value add. We were either buying for cash flow or we were developing ground up. And so you know, again, cap rates were compressing. We weren't doing value add. We could get, we're not an IRR shop, right? Like we created this promote structure with our investors 21 years ago where we cash flow promote, if you will, where it's not a GPLP structure. It's a member managers and an LLC. And we had a 51% vote of all of our partners, which were our investors. I always called them partners because they were, for major decisions like a sale or a refinance, because I didn't want anybody ever to say, hey, you're conflicted. You're doing this as the GP for your promote. So we wanted to have something where, you know, we weren't taking all the fees. And I go back to my real estate finance days and the lessons learned. I was able to watch what so many owners and operators and developers were doing. And I took the best of what people were doing to kind of create Forum.
What about the GPLP structure? You know, for those that don't know, what are some of the sort of adverse incentives that you've seen go on, and what did you want to avoid when you set your structure up?
I appreciate that. You know, I think the biggest thing was the lack of alignment of interest, in the sense that they were, and again, this is generally, most GPs have to have fees to keep the lights on. I was fortunate that I had my real estate finance business funding my keeping the lights on while I was building my real estate business. And they take, let's just say it's a 2 or 3% acquisition fee, and then they have to have a 5 or 10% co-invest, and they go get that from their buddies. It's like, well, how? And then they do all this work, and it may be a great cash flowing asset, but all of their equity, if you will, their built up equity, their sweat equity, is stuck in these projects until they sell. So their incentive is to sell, but the best thing for the LPs might be to hold in cash flow. And so there was that lack of alignment that I saw where it was just like fee, fee, fee. So we never actually took an acquisition fee on any deal. We still to this day don't. Rather, we had this contingent profits interest that we would roll in to these deals, and we wouldn't take any fees out at closing. Rather, we'd keep 100%. And it was contingent in the sense that, let's just say that there was an 8% preferred return, and after all investors got an 8% of all their money back, we'd get a 20% back end. Well, we did that. And so because we had this upfront cash flow promote, if you will, we got cash flow and refinance proceeds along the way. But upon a sale, investors had to get all their money back and that 8% preferred return before we got anything. And rarely did we sell, right? We wanted to buy these things. We wanted to cash flow. We would refinance a lot. And if we could pull 50 or 100% of our dough out, you know, we would. And we always use 10-year fixed rate debt. Maybe just another subject that I think people need to be aware of. Real estate, in my mind, people get in trouble for two reasons. One, their debt comes due or they're over-levered, right? And mm-hmm. It comes down to debt, because I've never met anybody that had no debt on a property that they gave back. Now, I'm sure it's happened in the history of our country, but I've never
heard of environmental liability or something.
That's right, yeah, who knows what it was. But coming from the lending side, and I had some buddies when I was financing for them in California, they said, oh, well, we use real low leverage. We're 55, 60% low leverage. And being a lender, I said, yeah, but what's your debt service coverage ratio? And they said, well, we're at a 120 in California. I said, well, look, I said, I'm in Michigan. I've got an 80% loan to value, and I'm at a 210 debt service coverage. They're like, well, that's way too much leverage. I said, no, I don't think you understand. I'm at 2.1 times debt service coverage. You're at 1.2 times. You don't get in trouble because of loan to value. You get in trouble because of debt service coverage. So now that cap rates have really started to squeeze and come down in all markets across the U.S., you know, today loans are debt service coverage constrained, not loan to value. So typically in the lending world, it's the lesser of a 120 or 125 or an 80% loan to value. Well, today, just given how, you know, where we are in the cap rate environment, you know, you're going to be, most loans are probably sizing in the multifamily world to 60% anyways, because they're at that 125 debt service cover.
Yes, yeah, said slightly differently, in a market like California, the rent to asset value is lower, Right. So your debt service coverage is tighter, even though your LTV is lower.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
So, but
Again, you don't get in
banks care
trouble
about
because of
cash flow,
LTV.
right? Banks care about cash flow when you're
That's
when the
right.
loan is getting serviced. They don't, I
That's
mean,
right.
you're the asset coverage helps your LGD, but if you never default, it's better than worrying about loss given default.
That's right.
Yeah.
You got to remember, in the GFC, most people had two black eyes and a broken nose, right? They didn't know what happened. We were in tertiary markets like, Fort Collins, Colorado, and Pueblo, Colorado, and Albuquerque, New Mexico, which may not be so tertiary anymore. But we didn't have any problems. And I would say if you're playing defense, it's really hard to go on offense. And so, like right now, in today's environment, we've just been patient, 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 not buying and shelving our developments. But I think that I would say, today's opportunity is debt and tomorrow's opportunity is going to be on the equity side. But I might also say that I think there's been capitulation. I think the equity opportunity is right at our front door right now as well.
The interesting thing, I follow like the multifamily REITs. I had this guy Bill Chen on. Bill, if you're listening, what up? Anyway, the multifamily REITs have not moved, and the stock market has seemed to be on a quite a ripper lately. And it'll be interesting to see what goes on in the future. Have you seen what are the debt markets doing for development right now? I mean, I noticed the
So,
mortgage market hasn't really come in all that much. I don't know if it's correlated
right.
or not.
Well, two things there. On the construction side, we have 71% less lenders from 1980 till today. So 71%. It's astronomical. There's a great chart I'm happy to share, McKinsey put out. And so I think the buzzword of the day is real estate credit, right? Like how to, well, I think there's a secular and structural change in our banking system that has created this. In the GFC, WaMu, Wachovia, which they're not here, they were doing 90% non-recourse loans. And it was like jokingly say, what could go wrong? So you fast forward today, these big bulge bracket banks like Wells Fargo, I mean, they're not even making construction loans. It's really the local or regional banks that are making the loans today. And again, I have a bias and a tilt towards multifamily, so I kind of look at it, in a box from that. But trying to get a construction loan for an office building today is extremely,
Yeah, forget
extremely
about
tough.
it.
Very right. But on the multifamily side, if you can get a loan, lenders are only going to their best borrowers, and they might give you 50, 55% loan to cost. So our credit vehicle, we, being a developer ourselves, we get a lot of lenders that call us and say, we've got a borrower, they can't get 45, 50% equity together. Would you provide them a preferred equity slash mezzanine loan and take them from 50, 55 up to 70, 75? So for us, we've got a huge pipeline.
We do like
Now,
unitranche stuff instead. Will you
we
just like
do,
take down the
right?
whole thing?
And we would like to do more of that. A year and a half ago, we could do note on note financing and just structure a whole loan, and we'd bifurcate the A note, the B note, or sell off the A note to a PacWest or, Bank of the Ozarks. Really, really tough today. It's just gotten even tighter, just given all the commercial real estate loans that are out there, the ones that aren't paying off, if you will. But huge opportunity going away. The debt markets are a great place to be. We're In
What,
that preferred
if I could
equity
just stop you,
mezzanine
I don't
loan.
mean to stop you, but what is going on in multifamily debt service coverage? It seems to me from the outside that the debt service coverage piece is pretty okay, but am I reading that incorrectly?
No, I think you're right. It depends on the existing construction. I think some of the issues, if is that where you're going? What are we seeing? Kind of what are the issues we're dealing with?
Well, sort of. What I'm really thinking of is it's interesting just hearing you talk about the lack of appetite potentially from banks. It's somewhat interesting to me how I think some of their commercial exposure might be tainting some of their willingness to touch multifamily, but I think multifamily is fairly healthy at the moment, but maybe I'm wrong.
It is. Look, across the nation, I think we're 94.5, 95% occupied. There are markets where we have oversupply, you know, the Phoenix Metro, Austin, Texas, the Southeast. But given the lack of new construction starts, so we're predicting in 2024, we're going to see 10 to 15% of normal construction starts. So as we, the demand side of multifamily is unassailable, right? They're just more needed. It's 50 more expensive for a monthly mortgage payment today than it is the monthly rental payment. So you look at that, we're not building enough housing as it is. You know, I was reading the economic report yesterday from, you know, the president's office. And, you know, there's just, I think the statistic was that between 2000 and 2020, housing prices have tripled while household income has doubled. So in other words, the price of housing rose by 50% more than household income has in the last 20 years. So it's the renter nation, right? And some people, it's okay. It's just, they actually prefer renting. But from multifamily fundamentals, if you fast forward 2 years and we absorb through this product because the lack of new that's coming, I think we're going to see another run in inflationary pressure in multifamily. It's like if there are two seats left on a Southwest flight, what happens to the price of those seats? They go up. Where we're starting to see, or where we see the stresses in multifamily on the value add kind of, you know, debt fund, we're going to go do the value add and our interest rate takeout's going to be 4%. Now it's 5.5, 5.75. People are just, I think, the hope of rates coming down has, in the last probably 4 to 6 weeks, gone away. Because if somebody's at SOFR plus, say, 300, 320, you're at an 8.5% rate today. That, if the Fed funds rate goes from down 50 or 75 basis points, and that's what my index I was borrowing against, it's just like my line of credit. If I have a home equity line of credit and it goes from 8.5 to 8, it really doesn't make a bit of difference. Or to 7.75. It really needs to go down to like 5.5. But the other thing I think that the construction and value add world is based off of short-term floating rate. So the Fed funds or SOFR. Long-term real estate debt, permanent financing is based off the 10-year treasury. So we could have a scenario where, and I don't know necessarily believe this, where the Fed funds and SOFR comes way down, but the 10-year treasury, the takeout, the permanent debt market stays high. So for a 10-year Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac loan today, you're probably in the 5.6 to 5.8 range. For a construction loan, you're probably SOFR plus... Right? Yeah, you're at 8.5.
Cool. So I'm borrowing at 8.5, and then I'm exiting into a market that's got higher than his at least recent history borrowing costs, right?
Right.
So my exit value is lower than it used to be, and my cost to construct from a financing perspective is higher, not to mention whatever inflation's done to my building costs.
That's right. But I think the way that developers think about it versus, you know, existing value add is, hey, the interest reserve is built in my total cost. I've got an interest reserve to cover this. Now, a lot of folks behind schedule, you know, blew through their interest reserve, have to rebalance their loan. That's some of the stress. And I would like to delineate, I don't think multifamily, it's not distressed. It's stressed because of the financing on it. But when you're 94.5, 95% occupied, you're fully occupied. I would argue that your rents are, you know, if you're 90, your rents are too low.
Yeah.
Right. Like we always think about 93%.
Push your rent a little bit. Yeah.
Right. Push your rent. But the stress is there where, you know, people are saying, hey, I've been feeding this thing. I thought we were going to have a takeout loan. And I think the capitulation has actually hit where it's like, hey, interest rates are not going to save us this year. We're actually going to have to sell. And I've got examples of it, like real life. And I think when Chairman Powell came out a few weeks ago and he was on 60 Minutes, maybe it was a month ago, I think what's happened is we've, now that we know rates are probably not going up, and I'm talking about Fed funds, there's a floor on values. And then people can say, okay, now we know where the floor is, but how much are rates going to come down? That's the $1 million. And when? And again, inflation is stubborn. The Fed's not going to all of a sudden just be like, hey, we're dropping 100 basis points, 200, you know, that could be over a 2 or 3 year period. Now, when your debt comes due and you can't refinance out, your debt comes due and you can't refinance out. So I guess the question becomes, why would you build today if you can go buy?
Yeah. The interesting thing to me is if you fast forward this discussion, like I think if it is true, like you said, inflation sticky, I think trueflation would disagree, but I think that some of the recent numbers are sort of appear to be getting hotter. Maybe I'm misreading that. Maybe not. If the Fed short-term rates stay higher, I don't know what conversation we're having in 2027, because it feels like a big shortage is on the come.
Right? Big shortage of housing.
Correct.
100%.
Now, single family homes, the home builders, they seem to be as well positioned as anybody because they can buy down mortgage rates and have sort of a financing arbitrage there. But man, I don't know. It's going to be very interesting to watch.
Well, I'm not leaving my 3% mortgage for a 7% mortgage as a homeowner.
Yeah. Interestingly, though, I've just transactioned on two houses, and I'd argue both the values that I got were very fair. I don't know that, you know, I mean, obviously, if I sold them 2 years ago, 2021 or whatever, 2022, right, they'd probably be a lot better. But like, it was not terrible by any stretch. So values don't seem to be coming down. And that, to me, is sort of anecdotal evidence of what appears to be a shortage in the data.
Yeah, there just are not a lot of trades. And to your point about single-family home builders, some investors with us, our partners here in Denver, they own large, you know, publicly traded single-family. You know, they're buying. They're like, it's as good as it gets right now. You know, they're buying that 7% mortgage down to 5. You know, existing home, you can't do that. And even in multifamily, you know, we can buy our rate down 200 basis points in fee, meaning it might save us 25, 30 basis points in overall rate. So it's meaningful, but it's not like we can buy it down 2%. We can't go from 5.5 to 3.5, or everybody'd be doing it. That would change things overnight. But I agree, the lack of housing that we're producing, and most of the developers that we're financing today are vertically integrated. They're a GC, they're a developer, and they're squeezing things on all sides. Like for us at Forum, outside this one project in San Diego that took through a rezone, our basis is so low, we can build to just over a 6 on cost, which is unheard of in California. If we can't get to a 6.25, 6.5 on cost, so the unlevered return on a development, we're not doing it. Now, there's a project in Glendale, Arizona we've been watching. We actually had under contract for $105 million 3 years ago. It was the first deal we were going to buy kind of at CO, and we dropped it. Offers are due next week, and I think it's going to trade around $72 to $75
million.
Hmm. So a $30 million drop over the last 3 years. Now that market's a little overbuilt today, ton of job growth, they'll work through it, but it's hard to want to go build when you can buy. And we're finally starting to see a decrease in construction costs here, and subcontractors, as they're getting done with work, are finally calling saying, hey, do you have any work for us? So we estimate costs are down kind of on wood construction here in Colorado around 10-11%. But we're also pricing, so insurance, we should talk about insurance. I mean, you want to talk about a wild card.
Dude, I'm in Florida. You want to have an insurance conversation? I'm happy to have it.
Well, I think that's actually the opportunity to buy in all these developers in Florida, like as they underwrote $600 a unit and it's coming out at $1,200 a unit, you know, stabilized. I don't know how they make any money, or maybe they get their money back on a development that if they're selling it. But
you know what's kind of interesting about that? Because you're talking about the opportunity of it. I just got on the house I just sold. We had we didn't have to, but I provided alternative quotes to the buyer. And I think it was two new insurers entered. And DeSantis finally got off his ass and somewhat addressed the insurance problem down here. I don't think it's a full address, but it's the beginning of one. And it appears as though we might be having insurers enter the market again. I talked to my insurance brokerage, you know, just like retail people. It could be getting better. And it would be interesting to see, to your point, if people are capitulating at max pain, and this actually is kind of a good opportunity to buy into the fear. Because until then, there has been no indication that insurance is going anywhere but up.
In the state of Louisiana, you cannot get insurance right now for multifamily. We own one legacy deal there that got hit by two named hurricanes within like 18 months, you know, and we actually got forced placed insurance from Fannie Mae because we just could not get it. So I think from a legislative standpoint, when California is no better, we have a house up in Lake Tahoe and, you know, the fear of wildfires, I think nationwide pulled out, Allstate, and you want to talk about upside down, the government there, or the government, you know, they basically said you can only raise rates 3%. So these people are taking huge losses, meaning the people, the insurers, they're just backing
out.
That's
what's
so I think
here.
Now, but we actually in Louisiana this year, you know, we're actually starting to see some insurers come. And look, it's a cycle just like everything. A couple of seasons without catastrophic wind claims or fire claims, things like that, they'll pop, you'll see people starting to pop back in. But our insurance in Louisiana went from $50,000 per year when we bought it 7 years ago to $850,000 per year. So if you did a six cap on that, or a set, I forget what, it was like a $13 million in value we lost just in insurance.
Yeah, that's wild.
So we've
got to push the rent.
We've got a legacy.
You got to push the rent. It's the way the math works, right?
Well, and look, I'm not going to get into politics and rental control, but you go to markets where, like I've always said, I will take market risk, but I won't take political risk. As soon as like St. Paul, Minnesota said, okay, you can only raise rents, you know, 3%, whether it's a new tenant or existing, well, my insurance just went up 50%. My real estate taxes just went up 40%. I'm underwater and the gap between income and expenses is going like this, where all of a sudden the government's forcing and creating foreclosures and negative debt service coverage covenants and things like that while they're trying to solve an affordable housing crisis or issue.
This is when I start thinking like, how can I get bearish multifamily? This is the scenario I fathom, because I worry that if there's not construction soon, in 3 to 5 years, we're going to have such a shortage that it's going to be like on the top of every rent specifically is going to be on the top of a lot of political minds. And then if you start to get into rent control, then I don't know, all bets are off for a little while. Although that's when I would actually consider making like a real bet, if you start to see values adjust on that.
Yeah, I know governments are trying. And look, we really focus on the renter by necessity, like not the renter by choice. The renter by choice is somebody who's like living in the penthouse over here across the street from where we're staying for $13,000 a month. I'm talking about the blue to kind of gray collar. It's a nice product. In San Diego, that renter by necessity makes $150,000 a year. But it's those folks that don't, they make a little bit too much to get truly affordable housing, you know, with the capital A. We're trying to provide that small A. And if you had told me going back, you know, Bill, to in 3 years, if we don't housing, we won't. I think the only reason why folks like ourselves are hesitant is that you can't, we see the data, but it's really hard to prove out and say, hey, in 36 months or 24 months, rents are going to start going up 5 or 10% a year. Just trust us, right? Otherwise, we'd all be firing up the, you know, tractors again and building like crazy. But when you look at, hey, we can build in Denver to a 5.5 on cost, you know, finance it with 8.5% construction debt and the takeout loan, you know, let's just say it's 5.5, we're pro forma, you know, it's kind of neutral leverage. It's like, why don't we just go buy something where we have more upside in rents? Why are we going to take the risk to go put a shovel in the ground and what have you? So I don't have the answer. By the time it's really evident, everybody will be doing it again. We do own some A++ sites that we're just not moving forward on. And they'll never be bad locations, but I'm never going to go do a bad or make a bad investment just for the sake of doing. I think we've proved that over the years.
Well, I'm going to take something that you said earlier. If cash is king and cash flow is queen, having nice sights is a hell of a rook, right? I mean, it's a feather in whatever, however I want to say it. It's a nice way to play offense once the opportunity becomes clear, and it's a nice thing to be able to wait with.
Right. And it's in my career, there have been times where I said, you can give me the land for free and it doesn't change this deal penciling or not. And there's times where the land does make a big difference. Like I mentioned in our San Diego project, but today you could give me the land for free and it doesn't move the needle. It doesn't make a 5.5 gap go to a 6.5 or 6.25 where, you know, you really, really are trying to create value in development.
So just my brain is not picking up exactly what you're saying. So do you mind explaining why the land doesn't make a huge difference right now?
Sure. I'll just give round numbers. Let's just say that we could build a garden style 3-story walk-up stick frame, you know, lumber framed asset for $350,000 a unit. And let's just say that the land underneath that was $30,000 a unit. So basically it costs us it's 10% of the whole project. Mm-hmm. It's not going to move the needle 50 or 75 basis points as far as being accretive to the overall development.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Meaning $270,000 or $300,000 per unit isn't going to change. Now, I mentioned like in Phoenix, that asset that we were looking at, you know, we were going to buy that for north of 300 when we went under contract, and now it'll trade for less than 250. And you can't build it for 250.
Yeah.
So you have all this product coming online, but a lot of folks are betting on, you know, neutral or negative leverage where they're buying a cap rate less than their debt and that they'll have very little or low rent growth, but it's all basis play for the future, which is, I guess, one way of looking at it.
Yeah, it's a way. How do you look at it?
So for us, you know, in our credit, while we're making mezzanine preferred equity loans, from a risk-adjusted return, if we have somebody that's putting 30% equity ahead of our loan, and let's just say it's $300,000 per unit all in, so our last dollar is at $210,000, their last dollar is $300,000. And look, I've never been in my life, I never had to take a property back, never been a loan to own. But if there ever was an issue, our theory is we'd love to own that project at $210,000 a unit. Now, we're getting paid SOFR, and I'm glad you're sitting down, SOFR plus 10 to 12%, right? So we're getting 17, 18%.
Yeah, that's nice.
With a net of, let's just say 16. So we're getting equity returns in debt. So why are we going to go do equity with same returns with less risk in debt? Now, again, I think that's going to change here. I think this is a year where people are going to capitulate. We're starting to already see it. And remember, within any market, the first deals you start seeing when the market's changed, probably the ones you don't want to do, but we're not far away of seeing the ones, you know, that we do want to do.
Huh, that's interesting. Why are the first ones? I think I know what you're saying, but I'm just curious. Why are the first ones the ones you probably don't want to do?
You know, like there's an office conversion to multifamily in the Arizona market. You know, that's just they're $30 million over budget on a night. You know, just things like that. Just maybe a different, like those were just bad. Those are distressed. They aren't stressed. They're distressed.
Yeah.
So those are the ones. There's an opportunity here in Denver. It's been all over the news, but you know, you're gonna have to take all the siding off, all the windows off. There's mold, like out of state developer. It's just I'm not getting anywhere near that. There, you couldn't pay me to do that. And by the way, this reminds me of something that I learned in the GFC. I actually think properties can have negative value, meaning you could give me I wouldn't take it. And we were looking at a property in Houston. And we could have bought this thing for, I'm going off of memory, let's say it was $25,000, $30,000 a unit. It actually had negative value because it had mold, it had everything that was wrong. Like if you gave it to me, it was worth less than replacement cost. So I didn't even want it. And I don't know that we're going to see that again. It just jogged my memory of, I never thought that somebody giving me, 10 acres with multifamily on it, I wouldn't take. Like, there's a value for everything. In that case, it was actually negative value.
Yeah. Well, that's the issue with replacement costs. The natural question is it worth replacing, right?
Right. Well, that I agree, because talking to a friend of mine from a multifamily REIT yesterday here in Denver, and he said, replacement cost story, I don't know. If it's a high rise, the exterior is always going to look good and you can redo the, interiors. He said, older product that's stick frame, the exteriors can get worn. And I haven't really fully digested or agreed with, I do agree that, high rise, and it's not really something we do, but the replacement cost is a fair argument. But for folks like us that need current cash flow or want current cash flow, and if it's very, very little, and I say very little, below, say 5%, probably not worth us waiting for 2 or 3 years, or at least we haven't seen those opportunities yet.
Yeah. That's interesting. If I heard you correctly and remember correctly, you said that right now is sort of the opportunities are in debt. You think that the opportunities for equity are maybe on the near horizon. If I asked you to put your fortune teller hat on, how do you think this all plays out? I think you've been talking about it, but I'd like to hear you specify.
Yeah, I think we'll be active buyers the second half of this year. I think we'll probably tie something up in the second quarter, but I think we'll be active buyers. And there's just such a, you've seen the charts, I'm sure, 2024 and all the debt that's coming due. And so because we've got different vehicles, which we can provide different, whether it's for ourselves or to third parties, there are a lot of loans that are just out of balance. There are a lot of interest rate caps where people were hoping that the cap costs would come down to re-up. There are folks that lenders are saying, hey, time's up. We give you enough extensions or pay us down. Or so whether it's a bridge loan that we can provide, whether it's equity and we're going out, and buying, I think the opportunities, again, the capitulation is there where folks, crossing their fingers or hoping, I always say hope's not a strategy, the rates are going to come down. I think the capitulation is there. So the question now is, how much more time do I have before my debt comes due, and what can I do to solve that problem?
Yeah, interesting. One of the things I was chatting with my dad about, and maybe it came up when you and I talked the first time, but one of the interesting sort of dynamics that I've been thinking about with multifamily is, as people live longer, older people that are choosing to move back into multifamily. Now, some are obviously nursing homes, but some aren't ready for that. They don't want to take care of a house anymore. And this is kind of a segment of the population that I have not historically associated with renting that may be looking to rent more. Are you seeing any of that in what you own?
We are. Actually, our CIO moved here from San Francisco, lived there for 30 years. He was portfolio manager with a $25 billion fund, and he's an empty nester now, and he rents. He said, one of the things in moving to Denver, I wanted to be able to walk to work. And he loves locking and leaving, right? They eat out a decent amount. They cook at home. He said, the only downside is, like, when we have, a bigger group of people come over, it's hard to kind of host like we would at our house. But they just love the flexibility. One of their kids is in Southern California, the other in New York. So they're gone a lot as well. So I think that's actually just been a shift in our culture that it's okay to rent.
Yeah, and you don't have to manage a house. Managing a house of pain.
That's right.
Can be.
You aren't kidding. Especially when you don't live there, right?
Yeah.
And he's, letting friends stay there. Do we rent it out? Do we put some of our stuff in storage? Again, another thing, my father-in-law always said, nothing in life stays the same. Your friends, your family, your health, your business. And I think that's one of the things at Forum that we've done a good job, and we have signs around, it's connecting the dots. Like, where's the market going? 8-9 years ago, we built, I mentioned Google's campus. We did 1 million square feet of retail. We would do non-multifamily here only in Colorado. But it was really hard for a guy like myself, who's more of an entrepreneur and a deal junkie, to say, okay, no more. We're only doing multifamily. We're doing the entire capital stack in multifamily and turning our entire business around. Like for real estate people like myself that, like I said, are deal junkies, it was like a tree with a lot of limbs but no roots. It's always about the next deal. It's like I probably shouldn't use this analogy, so I won't, but you know, somebody who's addicted to something, it's like, hey, I'm just gonna, to ease my pain, I'm gonna go do this. Well, for real estate folks, it's like, hey, I'm just gonna go to the next deal. We're gonna make more money on the next deal. So one of the hardest things in my careers was turning the whole shit and say, I'm gonna build a foundation and we're gonna stop. And the market timing was okay, because as I mentioned, cap rates are going down and you know, we stopped buying a lot. But now I've built a foundation where, and roots in the ground where we could add as many limbs on that tree as we want and it won't fall over. But I was at the point where if I just kept adding limbs, the tree was going to fall over at some point. We just couldn't keep growing without the foundation.
I like that. I like that a lot. I wrote it down. So
put it on your wall.
I may. My dad often says, like, look down, where are you? And he's sort of saying something similar but different. He's like, just pay attention to where your feet are and execute what's in front of you and maybe slow down a little bit rather than like spreading out the focus.
And seeing where life is going, like COVID was a huge shift, right? That, again, had the chance to move from somewhere to go to Vail, Colorado, and they never left. Or they, you know, you look at the U-Haul, you know, trucks, or just open your eyes and see where, like, all people are moving to and not going back to. And it was pretty easy to see that this wasn't really a transitory change. It was a structural change.
The interesting thing, and I may be mistaken, but haven't the Midwestern and Northeastern markets actually been like relatively stronger? Now, they probably took a write down, so it's strong off a lower base, but is that accurate?
It depends on where. So we were in Saginaw, Michigan. You probably never heard of Saginaw. And a lot of people from Michigan go back to Michigan. Junior college, like, but people were leaving there. Like, there's just not a lot of growth, but like, Kalamazoo with Pfizer, with Merck, you know, Ann Arbor, like Detroit, you know, area. There are just certain areas, or Columbus, Ohio, right? Where you all of a sudden start getting tech, you get biotech in these markets that, yeah, they're strong and rents haven't skyrocketed and costs. A friend of mine from Iowa City is a single family home builder, and he told me about this house that he built on. I said, what, like, you live on 63 acres, and I couldn't believe, you know, he said, I couldn't build a house for $2.5 or $3 million. Like I could build like a 100,000 square foot home or, you know, something huge, but just the cost differential. But a market like Iowa City, right? The university, the medical, there's a lot of wealth in Iowa City and Des Moines. You know, South Bend, Indiana, you've got, you know, in Indianapolis and Carmel, like, there's some great Midwest markets. It's some of these smaller markets that, you know, we owned in Jackson, Mississippi, and glad we did and glad we sold out of there. But they're just not, I jokingly say to people, I'm like, do you know what's going on in Jackson? They say, no, what? I said, nothing, absolutely nothing. Like, there's no economic driver to help really grow that market. Now, I'm not saying it's not a nice place to live or not, but for an apartment owner, there's just, it's like apartment stock's getting older, and the only thing new that's getting built is capital A affordable, like LIHTC type stuff, if anything. So there's just not a lot of growth in that market.
Yeah, not the best place to own an equity asset in.
Right.
I used to have a guy, I was a trainer at a gym. He was sort of abusive to me, but I liked it for some reason. I should probably sit on a couch and figure that out. He used to call me Muffin Top. And he'd be like, top, you got to buy in Kalamazoo because Pfizer's going there. Turns out he was right.
Right. We own there.
Yeah, there you have it.
It's great.
Oh, well, sometimes the abusive are right. He was something. Anyway.
That's my old joke. If I ever get the urge to exercise, I just sit back down on the couch and it goes away.
I don't know, man. I've had good luck with trainers, but not on my own. I'm not good at self-motivating in the gym. You said you had a tryout for the Falcons?
Yeah, a long time ago, I played at Colorado, played linebacker, and I was our fullback for short yards and goal line. And so, yeah, I was built like a linebacker, not like a fullback. So That was back in 98, our Super Bowl year. Unfortunately, I blew out my neck, and know why most fullbacks retire from the NFL because of a neck problem. So
that sucks.
There we go.
Is it still playing you at
all? Great experience. Met some great people.
I'd imagine.
Met some still great friends, investors. Yeah, it's been great.
I've been teaching my kids to respect the fullback position.
It's hard to find these days.
Yeah. When I see him, though, I'm like, watch this guy block. Because my youngest, all he wants to do is talk about quarterbacks. And, you know, but he learns. You know what's helped them a lot is Madden.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they actually understand football.
Right.
We were watching the playoffs. I was asking them about calling defenses and stuff. And, like, they get it.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool. So.
Yeah, we've got a dozen or so athletes. And not that I'm looking for them, but it's typically the wealthier ones that have the capacity to make the investments. And I found that athletes like real estate because they can see it and touch it and really understand it versus being in a private equity fund or something that they don't know. But it was always a joke, you know, what's the next deal in the locker room that's coming, you know, being passed around. So,
well, better that than spending it, right?
Yeah. Well, many, many stories about people spending it and, you know, you're one play away from the end of your career.
Yeah.
And
especially NFL, and that's not guaranteed money either, right?
That's right.
So it's different.
That's right.
Interesting. So when you were in college, like, how did you start? I know you said you got into financing real estate. Like, how do you go about building a million square foot facility and protecting your own risk? Like, how do you structure that deal? And where'd you learn to structure those kind of deals? I assume it was on the debt side, mitigating risk, but.
When I was in college, I was doing landscaping and decks and fences and stuff like that in the summer. So I was hiring all my football buddies to help me out on the labor crew. But there's nothing like real life experience. You know, my wife was at the University of Denver in a master's in real estate. And when I was in finance and the professor asked me to come in and talk and my wife's got her, you know, book and trying to write down, like do all. And I said, hey, this is an HP 12C. This is all you need. You don't need to memorize just like the Pythagorean theorem or whatever. You don't need to memorize any of this stuff. But maybe to answer your question, to me, experience in the number of transactions you do. So like for me on the real estate finance, the number of transactions was more powerful than the years in the business. It's not about how many years you've been doing something. It's about the number of transactions or investments or loans that you've made and underwrite. Because if it quacks like a duck, it walks like a duck. It's probably, no two deals are ever the same, but there's a lot of similarities. And so I've always looked at things more in the sense of like, how do we get in trouble? Not how much money are we going to make? Because I think as soon as folks start looking at like licking their chops and saying, hey, here's how much money we're going to make, the game's over. It's how do we get in trouble? The last thing you ever want to do, and one of the things I'm most proud of, we've never done a capital call outside of like a fund where you have drawdowns yet, but like where a deal was over budget. Like we've never had a development over budget or we had to do a capital call or anything like that because, again, we use lower leverage. And I would rather take the risk, say, on a development once we build it and stabilize it on the permanent loan and leverage using more leverage there if we were going to do it, than leveraging up on the construction side. So again, you get in trouble for two reasons. You're over leveraged or your debt comes due. So it always comes back down to debt. But just observing a lot of folks, developers, you know, my father-in-law was a huge, he doesn't know it, but a mentor to me in a way. And it was, his name is Dick Landon. I call him the Dickisms. He has these sayings. Darren, when the ducks quack, feed them. It's like, when the market's hot, sell, right? You never get broke taking a profit, you know, things like that. And so he'd been through it all. He moved down from Canada in 1980 with Pat Bowlen, the former owner of the Denver Broncos. And they were 30 years old, didn't go to high school. He didn't. Had a $5 million in the bank, a $30 million line of credit from one of the Canadian banks. And they said, hey, pick Denver or Santa Barbara and go work out all of our problems in real estate. And so he helped me because they were wheeling and dealing in real estate. And then they got in the banking business and the SNL crisis hit. And then They took their lumps. And so he learned a lot. And just talking to me at the dinner table, and he lives in Denver with his wife here as well, where my wife, Blake, grew up for most of her life. And just, you know, just those lessons learned from him, just talking like the Dickisms. He doesn't realize how many of those sayings like stuck with me. I got that cash flow is queen from him, right? And to this day, I'm always focused on how much you got to have cash as well. And like, I wish there were some developments that we didn't sell, but it also helped me grow my business more. But the cash flow, if there are goals for me, I've always had goals around cash flow, not about cash.
Interesting. So on the Google campus, or how did you mitigate your risk? Do you subcontract all that out?
So we have never been a contractor ourselves. We thought we were going to entitle more residential land and maybe a hotel, maybe retail. And we got a call from Google. It was like this top secret, you know, it's almost like the US government, right? They don't want you to know. We ended up signing a long-term lease with them. So we did a build-to-suit for them. So with our contractor, we had what's called a GMP, a guaranteed maximum price.
Yep, that makes sense.
They guarantee a price. They buy out the subs. And one of the things we do a little different, a lot of folks, developers, don't buy out all their subcontracts. They do it over the project. Well, if there's a cost inflation, you get stuck.
Yep.
So we always want to buy out 75 to 80% of our subcontract before we break ground. And we actually do the same when we make loans to our developers, because we don't want them to be over budget or get below cost. We also, rather than just having a lender contingency, we have a lender contingency, we have an owner's contingency, and then we have a contractor as a contingency. Then we have a joint contingency with our contractor that we can agree upon. So if there's cost savings on top. So one of the reasons, again, we always want a cash cushion just in case, just be safe. And some people say, well, there's a drag you raised, you know, or have more equity that's just sitting there. Yeah, but never done it. I'm sure if that same person, I said, hey, I'm, you know, doing a capital call because we're over budget, would say, gosh, I wish you had more contingency or something. So we've always, again, rather play it safe. But that Google development, I do it again. We sold it to Google. There's a whole nother story for another time, but that was an interesting process selling to them as well.
Well, the cap makes sense, right? I mean, that's I built this house and I was really worried about inflation. And I signed fixed price contracts because I was like, look,
right.
I got to know what I'm going to spend. Like, I can't just.
It's an insurance policy.
And then the roofer came back and he didn't procure his stuff. And I said, look, man, I'm not trying to be a dick, but we signed a fixed price contract. That's your business problem, not mine.
Well, and you know how many people, my sisters, you know, hired a contractor and, you know, they over, but people just aren't, they just don't know. But even on a remodel, because it's like, well, until we open the walls up, we don't know what we're going to find. Okay, well, give me a budget. And before you go and do the work, I need to sign off on it, right?
Yeah.
A change order.
Yeah.
Like, if you give folks, you know, an open budget, they'll spend it.
Yeah.
Because there is none. There is no budget.
Yeah. Well, I heard a story. It's either somebody that lives around here or somebody that knows lives around, you know, whatever. The boat's name is change order. So
I like that.
Yeah. All right, cool, man. Well, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you'd like to talk about? And regardless of the answer to that question, if this is close to the end, let people know where they can find you and how they can contact you. And I'll put it in the show notes too.
Oh, I appreciate it. Yeah, we're forumre.com. Happy to help any way I can with folks as they're going through their journey in real estate. But, you know, one of the things that I was thinking about, what would be one wish I had in commercial real estate or commercial real estate finance today? And Debbie Jenkins, who's at Freddie Mac, I have a decent relationship with her. And every time I see her in DC, I say, Debbie, if there's one thing you guys ever do, please come out with a construction to perm financing program for Freddie Mac. And I would say the same thing to Fannie Mae. If I had a wish, construction, where that's one way where I think you'd really get more housing built and housing started, where where we knew where our insurance policy, just like you said about a GMP, you know, locking in those prices. If I knew, you know, and life insurance companies do some of that where they can do like a 10 or 12 year construction perm. But if you had the agency backing, because it's, you know, let's just face it, we have twice as many lenders in multifamily than we do in commercial real estate, just because we have Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and HUD supported by the U.S. government. So HUD is an arduous process to get through on the construction side. But if I had one wish for multifamily today, it'd be that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac could provide 7+ year construction perm financing, because it'd provide more lending options to our space, and it would provide, you know, lower cost financing to our space as well. So that's what I would probably leave with is my wish.
You may have said this, and I apologize if my mind drifted while you're talking, but I was thinking, like, if you had what you're asking for, you could almost have like a yield the worst on your project, right?
That's right. Yeah. You nailed it.
Yeah, that would be nice. Right. Then you can sort of pencil things out and know where you stand.
Well, and look, the regulators are hammering the banks for, you know, reserves and what have you. And so they're just out of the market. Like, the big bulge bracket banks are just out. So you have a way for the government to get involved and not make it a negative involvement, a positive involvement to create more housing, whether it's the capital A affordable or the little A affordable. We're providing more multifamily housing through these construction programs. And hopefully somebody from back east is listening and we can get something going, because it really would make a huge dent in providing more housing.
Yeah, well, if they don't, then it's up to the private markets and the pricing is going to be higher.
That's right. That's what's happening.
Yeah. Yeah. The golden age of private credit, as they say.
Right.
All right, cool. Well, thank you so much for stopping by. It was a great conversation. It's been nice getting to know you. It was a nice pre-call conversation, too. So when I'm out
likewise,
in Denver, I'm going to hit you up.
I know you're invested with some local friends here, so congratulations. Great group. And if you ever have time when you're in Denver, I'd love to get together with you. So thanks for including me.
Yeah, thank you. Have a good one.
Take care.
All right. Too. Bye. Yeah.